While the Australian government's initial response to wiki leaking was, in my view and many others, excessive and overexcited, although I must say Rudd handled it better than the Prime Minister. On the other side, we've got WikiLeaks and the internet being nominated for the 2011 Nobel Peace Prize. Now, whether you believe all the things that are open to disclosure or not, Assange is an interesting character, someone that Robert Mann describes as one of the best known and respected human beings on earth. That's why I read that extract from his essay. Bob's from La Trobe University. He's been looking at who the real Assange is, and it's the next edition of the monthly comes out on Friday, but we're having a sneak preview. Robert's on the blower from Melbourne. Thanks for coming on, Robert. When does Julian Assange first become seriously interested in the political possibilities of leaks?
Well, I think quite early in the piece. He was in both legal trouble in the mid-1990s because he was hacking in a quite extraordinary way, and it took a couple of years to settle his case. But he was also fighting a custody battle for a son. And I think that's when he got interested in leaks, and he was, I think, getting material from the Department of Social Welfare, or what it was called at the time, I can't remember. And I think then he began thinking about the possibility of leaks. He says, and a lot of things he says I have questioned a bit, he says that he started a .org leaks internet site, 99, but I discovered in stuff that he'd written that in fact by 1996 he had already had a newsletter called Leaks, so he probably misremembered, but anyhow it was very early in the piece that he began to think about leaks as something that could be politically potent.
We used to have Soulette Dreyfus as a regular on the program, and she introduced us to Julian way back when.
Yes.
When he was involved in a movement known as the Cyberpunks.
No.
Cypherpunks, Cypherpunks.
It was a kind of play on words. The Cyberpunks are sort of novels, science fiction, kind of low-life novels. But someone made a joke. Now, I don't know Soulette knew him before, I think. He was involved with the Cypherpunks, but he got involved anyhow in the... towards the late 1990s with them, or 1995, and had 7 years of involvement with them. And I came to the view by looking at material that was when he really got his political education. It is the unknown story, really, or the beginning of the unknown story, because there's been millions of Google references to Assange.
But remarkably superficial stuff, really. And this is...
That's what amazed me. The true story is that I had just been reading newspapers about Assange and getting terribly interested in the present question of WikiLeaks and, the astonishing leaks that are to do with Afghanistan and Iraq and then these US State Department leaks. So I was like an ordinary kind of listener to your program just following it. And I decided really to write a comment on the, just the general question of is it a good thing and all that, and these difficult questions. So I started, Googling away as one does. And I just came upon this absolutely fascinating material on the internet, which I think all journalists, including some of the best journalists in the world, for Vanity Fair and New Yorker, just hadn't taken the trouble to look at.
Well, even looking at the cypherpunk philosophy,
yes,
the belief that the great question of politics in the age of the internet was whether the state would strangle individual freedom and privacy through its capacity for electronic surveillance, or whether autonomous individuals would eventually undermine and even destroy the state through their deployment of the new electronic weapons at hand.
Yep.
That's a hell of a sort of a mission statement, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it started in San Francisco, and what I call the Silicon Valley masters of the universe types, really intelligent often very quirky, business people who'd made a fortune in, intellectual revolution, or professors of mathematics. They got together, and they were, they're really anarchists, mostly of the right, actually, libertarian anarchists. But they thought the great battle of the day was whether the state would get control of the internet and suborn individuals.
Nick, I'm glad you've raised that, because we have to recognise that this transcends the usual left-right model, doesn't
yes.
it?
Well, the cypherpunks were generally, I suppose Australians would think of as neoliberals or economic rationalists, except they were very hostile to the state, and the Americans call them libertarians, but quite a lot of them were left rather than right-wing libertarians. And I took a lot of trouble trying to work out where Julian Assange fitted in, and it's a very complicated story.
Well, you've got to give us your tentative conclusion on that.
The tentative conclusion during the cypherpunks period was that there's electronic libertarianism, the fight against the National Security Agency and the state. I think he was a real extremist on the hardline electronic libertarian who just would not put up with any state interference with individual liberty. On the other hand, he was, from the point of view of normal left-right economics, he was more a left-wing libertarian or a left-wing anarchist, in that he just didn't believe in the neoliberal philosophy of pure market and laissez-faire capitalism. So he had quite a complicated position, which comes from his postings, which are all available if anyone took the trouble to read them. So he is a very hard line on the question of, struggle against the state trying to suborn individuals who want to communicate privately on the one hand. On the other hand, he's not an Ayn Rand type, to put it simply, and whereas a lot of them were.
Robert, I began tonight's program by reading that splendid quote of yours about contrasting him with Rupert Murdoch, the two most influential Australians, of all time, I would suspect. And as you point out, there are very few original ideas in politics, yet you'd argue that the creation of WikiLeaks is one.
That's right. Well, you see, I won't defend the position that there aren't many original ideas, but I want to say why I think WikiLeaks was original. At the centre of the cypherpunks is the idea of what can be made of individuals communicating in a way that no one can trace through cryptography and what was called remailers, which are ways of disguising messages between people. And what Julian Assange did is use those ideas and connect them to the idea of leaks. And to go through, it's really quite complex, but essentially he thought that people inside institutions, authoritarian institutions, either states or corporations, would be able to, to send their material in a way that was completely immune to being, seen by authority. They could, as it were, blow the whistle on institutions if they could, if there was a place they could send the information to which was completely secure. And he set up WikiLeaks in a way, not because he believed in freedom of information, although he does. He set up WikiLeaks because he thought it was a way of crippling authoritarian institutions, because the members of those institutions would begin to fear that someone inside their organisation was going to blow the whistle on their corrupt practices and authoritarian behaviour, and they would then not be able to communicate with each other, because they would always fear that anything that was electronic might be leaked. And he saw thus a way of using cryptography, remailing, and the system of leaking as a way really of revolution, to put it simply, of threatening all institutions.
And he casts a very wide net. I was reading a New Yorker essay today on WikiLeaks' impact on Scientology, for example.
Yes.
It's a long agenda, but there's this endless emphasis, almost predictable, I guess, that he's simply anti-American.
And
that's nonsense,
isn't it? Well, it's nonsense. And see, he doesn't target anyone. I mean, his view and the view of WikiLeaks is that any institution and any leak should be published. And I think, he actually published stuff that I feel very ambivalent about. And that, you know, that is the ClimateGate emails, which I think did a lot of damage on the eve of Copenhagen.
Yes, we didn't like those WikiLeaks.
But see, he is actually a very intelligent person. I mean, I think an astonishingly intelligent person, and also very, as it were, consistent, in that his argument would be we can't begin to pick and choose. What our philosophy is that if there is something there to be leaked, we will do it. And he'll defend himself on that question. But he is very much against the idea that members of WikiLeaks, and there were quite a lot of volunteers, although a very tiny staff, he's against the idea that they can pick and choose what they leak. It is their job to be, as it were, neutral in regard to all organisations and institutions. So he doesn't sort of target Scientology, although he hated it. It was that leaks were coming, and he was going to publish them.
The Chinese aren't too happy with him either.
I bet they're not. In fact, this is another thing. See, astonishing material was that the first month of WikiLeaks, one of the people he approached decided, in a sort of insane way, that it was a CIA front. So he published all their internal communications for the first month. And what they show is, at the beginning at least, it was the Chinese that they had best access to. I think they had a hacker who was getting into the Chinese government.
A Taiwanese hacker.
A Taiwanese hacker.
Yeah.
That's, anyhow, what seems to appear from this first month of communications. And the Chinese, I mean, if they ever got the material from the Chinese and published it, God only knows what would happen to Julian Assange. I mean, it would make what the Americans are doing seem like a tea party.
Were you cranky when the Australian government did sort of started to parrot the American line on Assange and WikiLeaks?
Yes, I was, just in the sense that, I'm so sick of Australian governments parroting the American line that when it happens, my teeth are on edge. And I was, I was incredibly relieved that Kevin Rudd, and clearly for his own political reasons in part, distanced himself from McClelland and from Julia Gillard, because, what was being said was ridiculous and it was not thought out. And the idea that he'd somehow broken Australian law is ludicrous, because, at least in this case, he was publishing leaks which were coming from the American government, and we're not the 52nd state or whatever at the moment. So it couldn't possibly be a breach of our law then to be doing that, whatever else might be thought about him. So it was very thoughtless, and it was typical of, from the way I look at it, the way in which the Howard period has not worn itself out yet, and even the present government toes the line.
Have you made any deductions about Julian Assange as a human being, leaving aside his prodigious intelligence? This is coming into play a lot at the moment, of course. He's being demonised for, his alleged sexual misconduct and so on. But what sort of a human are we looking at here?
Well, he's, I think, prodigiously intelligent. He also combines a number of different forms of intelligence, which is very unusual. He's obviously a brilliant computer person, an abstract thinker in that way. One of the things that people don't know about him is that he's a wonderful writer. I didn't know it, but until I started reading the stuff that appeared in the Cypherpunks and other a blog that he wrote, which journalists, to their shame, have not looked at carefully. He writes beautifully. He's got real literary ability. He's got a lot of interest in physiology and psychology and so on. So he's got an enormously curious, wide-ranging intelligence. He's also politically brilliant. I mean, there's some stuff that if journalists had tried to find, they would have. Some of his emails to volunteers are politically incredibly acute, stuff that he wouldn't say in public.
Give us a for instance. What are you saying?
Well, I mean, it's very funny. He gets involved in social forum. He himself goes to Nairobi, Kenya. But then the next one is in the United States, and he sends a series of emails to people asking them to go to, I think it's Atlanta, where they're going to meet. And he, for example, I'll just give one example. Some of the people are obviously on the left, and he disapproves of them. And he says, look, I'm not going to put up with your, what he calls, the progressive commie socialist agenda. Don't get your dander up, he says. I've put up with you saying all these sorts of things, but if we, I don't believe you know, in the evils of capitalism and white supremacism, but I listen to your stuff. But if we get thought of as a same old left-wing organization, we won't have any influence at all. We have to be, you know, absolutely pure, as Caesar's wife, as it were.
Not only pure, but full of surprises.
Yeah.
Unexpected shifts.
You know, another thing is that, you know, this is, you know enough about my background to know what this will mean. He understands the evil of communism. I mean, you know, he's not just sort of, you know, a kind of social democrat or something. He one of his great heroes is Alexander Solzhenitsyn.
Yeah.
And he likes him or admires him for his courage, and he quotes him a lot, but also for the fact that he was the person that stood up against the Soviet state and the KGB. And again, it's so obvious that he's not a sort of standard left-winger. One of the ironies, actually, is that people like John Pilger are now his great supporters. But in fact, or Michael Moore, you know, the filmmaker, but Assange doesn't respect people like that in reality. His own position is infinitely more complex. And certainly, he's a different generation from that sort of, from the, you know, the John Pilger left. And he's also, he says to Dom Scheidberg, actually, that he thinks Michael Moore's an idiot, which is not complimentary and is in a way quite arrogant, but that's the way he thinks. So he's a very, very complicated and unusual. But you ask him that as a person, and I think there's something about his inability to handle people and not to suffer fools gladly, which I think gets everyone, you know, sort of against him.
A touch of the Malcolm Turnbulls there, perhaps.
Yeah, even more in a way, I think. And he's also, you know, he's very eccentric, and he doesn't change his clothes, and he, you know, doesn't shower much, and doesn't eat unless he wants to.
That's something that he and I have in common.
I actually find that stuff delightful, because it has the edge of genius, actually, of someone so kind of entranced in their own world of ideas that all the social niceties are forgotten. I find him endearing. I think his attitude to women, from the blogs I read, I don't mean what he did, and I have no idea, but what he thinks about women also is a bit terrifying to me, and I disapprove. I think he's rather sexist.
Asking Bob Carr in this very studio whether he'd ever been politically affected or even influenced by what was happening in cyberspace. And he thought about it for about 5 seconds and said, emphatically no. You know, and his view was old media was still calling the shots. And I must say, in the run-up to the second Iraq war, the ability of the net to organise those mass rallies around the world, which were then totally ignored, by the heavies, suggested that perhaps it wasn't going to have the clout that was anticipated. This changes the rules, doesn't it? This is profound.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, what he is a creative thinker, and he worked out in a way that no other cypherpunk worked out that you could turn the capacity of people to communicate with each other in more or less perfect privacy, turn that into a political weapon against authoritarian institutions and corporations, so that, you know, it's not sort of just ordinary thinking about new media in the way we do say about what's going on in the Middle East now, where it is terribly important, but it's thinking about it in a creative way. And can I say, as a historian, I mean, I'm, you know, you and I are not new media people, I think.
I'm afraid not, Robert. No.
But nevertheless, you know, I found just sitting in the country, Googling away, that I could do what I used to have to do by going to archives. There's so much material now stored, if you're willing to look.
Hasn't been that willingness to look.
Hard work.
Yeah, but it's been such a surface response, and a lot of the observations I think are simply banal. There's one, which in his defence used all over the place, you know, First Amendment stuff about freedom of speech and the fact that he's sort of a super duper form of journalist, but he's not.
He's not a journalist.
He's
not a journalist at all, actually. But even if he was, to some extent, a journalist. And he has to defend himself like that because, as you know, the way in which he might meet the charges that the United States brings against him is to argue on First Amendment.
Yes, he's setting that up as a defence, yeah.
But in fact, I mean, what he is, and I'm sure he knows this, and I hope in his book he's honest about it, he is a revolutionary. Not a non-violent revolutionary. He believes that in the possibility of using leaks to bring about a better world. And insofar as I'm attracted to what he's done, and I am, even though I have disagreements and so on, it is because, I think he's the first person I've seen for a very long time who really has got a way of threatening the extremely powerful. I mean, I think, the John Pilgers and so on don't, in fact. And I think I don't think Michael Moore in any serious way does either. But I think what he has discovered, that all authoritarian systems are threatened by really secret leaking.
And not only the state, also those mini-states known as corporations.
Mini-states known as corporations, and not only the states of the Middle East or the states of China or the West, all states are threatened, because it is true that if the real behaviour of almost any institution is revealed to the world, there are a lot of people who are threatened.
Robert, thank you for that. Robert Mann, Professor of Politics at La Trobe. His essay on Assange is in the latest edition of The Monthly, which will be out on Friday. On our next, I talk to American documentary filmmaker Pamela Yates and to a fascinating Australian historian and writer, Anna Lanyon. Stick around now on ABC Radio National for the news, and we will see you later.